Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, a podcast that is dedicated toward bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Thank you so much for taking this ride with me and with us as we look to do just that. You know, it's in these days and times, it's kind of a struggle with all that's going on as I record this, with the COVID-19 pandemic ramping back up, and even as the protests are exacerbating the situation between the police and the communities, you know, it's really just a problem. But we'll get through it and we'll get to it, right? As long as we have a focused goal on bridging that divide, we'll make sure that we achieve everything that we need to. So I have a special guest for today, one who I've been looking forward to having on for a long time. Now, we recorded this actually before the pandemic outbreak and before the George Floyd protests and all that is going on with that. When the protests started and when the pandemic started, I wanted to get some episodes about that. So that kind of interrupted our flow. But anyway, so I have a great speaker for us today, a great interview. His name is Corey Pegues. Let me read to you a little bit about him. Corey Pegues, a Queens, New York native, is a retired NYPD executive, as well as an author, motivational speaker, community leader, and expert on police-related topics. His career spans over two decades and speaks for itself. Subsequent to his discharge from the Army, Corey entered the New York City Police Department in 1992. Upon graduation from the academy, he was assigned to the 114th Precinct, located in Astoria, Queens. He was promoted to the rank of sergeant 5.5 years later, where he was promoted to the rank of lieutenant in 2002. 2006, he was promoted to captain, and only after 11 months, his strong work ethic, knowledge of police and work and leadership was recognized, and he was transferred to the Police Service Area Number 2, where he was assigned as the commanding officer. In 2008, Police Commissioner Ray Kelly promoted Corey to the rank of deputy inspector. June of that year, he was assigned as the commanding officer of the 67th Precinct, which was one of the most violent precincts in New York City. After nearly 4 years of successful crime reductions and excellent community police relationship building, in January 2012, Corey was assigned to the Patrol Bureau Brooklyn North. A little more than 21 years of exemplary service to the citizens of New York, Corey retired in 2013. So that's his story. He's got a lot more of the things that he's done. He wrote a book called Once a Cop, My Journey from Former Crack Dealer to the Highest Ranks of the NYPD. So we're going to discuss that book today. I'd like to have him back on to talk about these different protests that we got going on, but we'll get him to that place. He tells a story about his, you know, days and times as a drug dealer until he joined the highest ranks of the NYPD. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get it right into the interview. Make sure that you subscribe, share, and like, and support the podcast through PayPal, Cash App, and Venmo. So, former NYPD executive Corey Pegues, here is the interview. All right, man. So, thank you so much for being on Captain Hunter's podcast. We're here with Corey Pegues, and I really appreciate you coming on the show. Been looking forward to this for a long time.
I'm glad. I'm really happy that you had me.
All right. So why don't you just, I did read the bio to the audience. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've been doing the last couple months?
Yeah. Well, again, yeah, my name is Corey Pegues. I'm a best-selling author of a book called Once a Cop, The Street, The Law, Two Worlds, One Man. My story is basically, as a misguided young kid, I was in the streets, sold drugs, did a lot of crazy things, carried guns, and then I changed my life to become one of the top executives in the New York City Police Department, which is the biggest police department in the country, third biggest army in the world. And along the way, I got my bachelor's, my master's. I was a professor on and off for the last 15 years. And I'm a motivational speaker, and I go and speak about law enforcement topics. I'm a TV talking head, also radio, print media. I write op-eds. So the whole gamut. I got a feel-good story, you know, book on transformation. You know, basically, just like somebody just lifting themselves up from the bootstraps and making something out of their lives when every door, you know, it seemed possibly closed. I was able to knock those doors down and make some out of my life.
Absolutely. And so when I was checking out your book, man, I really appreciated the fact of how you really kind of showed the outline of your life from being a young kid to the street hustler and then going to the Army and then, of course, going to the going through the ranks of the NYPD. I wanted to talk about your childhood a little bit, man. Just give us a little breakdown of your childhood. I know you grew up kind of dirt poor. Like many African-American kids, man, just tell us about those experiences.
Yeah, actually, I actually didn't in the beginning grew up dirt poor. I had the, you know, American dream, mother, father, a house, a car, white picket fence. Then in the third grade, my father left. My mother was on welfare, trying to raise six kids on welfare. It's pretty hard at that time. You know, what's was startling, and if you read my book, I always say that it took me so many years to realize it was better for her to be on welfare than for her to go get a job making like $3 an hour, because with welfare, she was able to give us not only get money, but she was getting food stamps and more importantly, get us medical and dental. That's why my teeth are good right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. It took me all these years to realize, you know, I'm like, my mother never had a job. Not that she was lazy. It was like it was the best thing to do to take care of the kids, you know, when you have so many kids. And so, you know, after he left, things went downhill. Lights went off. Gas went off. Sometimes we didn't have no running water, eating mayonnaise sandwiches, bologna sandwiches, you know, government cheese, or cereal with carnation milk, or sometimes water because we didn't have none. So it was a tough road. It was a tough road. And then around the age of 13 is when I started dabbling in the streets. You know, this one of the OGs approached me and a friend of mine. I was like, listen, I give you $20 off every 100 loose joints that you sell. The loose joints was marijuana rolled up in bamboo paper. And sound like a plan to me. I was 13 years old when sometime hand-me-down jeans from my older sisters because I had no brothers. And we started doing that. And from then on, you know, I've been taking care of myself since the age of 13.
Now, when you, the lure and the temptation of that type of life had to be very strong, right? You said, you talked about how you were growing up eating, at a certain age, started eating bologna sandwiches, mayonnaise sandwiches, you know, cereal with water. And so therefore, here comes along someone with this tempting offer. And that is so tempting to many other kids who are going through the same type of situation, right? They're trying to look for that quick cash to make it out of that situation that they're in.
Oh yeah, you know, you gotta realize this is like in early to mid 80s. You know, it wasn't like these kids today. Back then we had an Britannica encyclopedia. If you had it set, you was able to go through it, read, figure out what the world was about, different jobs and stuff. It wasn't like today where the kids got the world at their hands, called a Google search engine. We didn't have that. I grew up around gangsters, pimps, and hustlers. So the probability of me working on Wall Street was very nil, rare at, you know, it wasn't good. And so, product of my environment, not telling kids to be a product of their environment, but that's the life that I chose back then. That's who I was hanging with, and that just was the lifestyle. If you wasn't doing it, you actually wasn't one of the cool guys. And you got to understand, like, all of those guys, they was riding Mercedes, BMWs, cell phones when cell phones first came out, the big cell phones in their cars, you know, big jewelry, latest gear. And that's really what I was just trying to do. I wasn't trying to be John Gotti, a major mob figure. I was just trying to get some sneakers, some clothes, and throw some food in my belly. So to give me 20 off every 100, you know, we was moving like 500 a day easily. So that was $100. We bust that down 50 a piece. You know, the bus was 50 cent at that time. You know, a hero sandwich was like $1.50. Man, I had money in my pocket every day. A pair of Pumas was $30, $29, $30. So it was good. And at that time, you got to understand, this is pre the war on drugs. The police really wasn't around. It was a reactive department where, like, if something happened, they showed up. It wasn't like today where they're more proactive trying to figure out and strategize where the next crime was going to happen. That wasn't happening back then. And then, as you know, as I graduated to work for one of the most notorious drug gangs in America. We was giving a cop $15,000 a week, so police really wasn't a factor back then.
Right, right, right. So you had a good friend, I think his name was Smooth, and now he went to a private school or something like that, and he was selling up there. I'm bringing that up because I want to talk about how some kids are kind of given the world, and where other kids have to struggle and hustle and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, Smooth, aka Sean Dew. Smooth, aka Sean Dew, still my brother, very best friend in the world. I'm his kid's godfather. He's mine. He actually retired as a correction officer. Yeah, he had everything. He had the house, two cars, and a white picket fence. Mom's worked for his telephone company. Father worked for the post office. Had the latest clothes, fashions. You know, you read in my book, he gave me my first leather jacket. He had it all. But again, it was about the environment. It was the environment. He didn't have to do none of the stuff I was on. You know, I used to go to his house and eat all the time. You know, he was cooking at the age of 13, driving cars at like 14, 15. We was driving. His sister used to give her her car. So he is a perfect example of somebody that had it all that went left. But he went left and was really smart about it. He was very smart about it. Had an exit strategy plan. He was pegged to go to college. And, you know, when the times, once he graduated high school, he went right to Hampton University.
Okay.
Right to Hampton. So the temptation was there. We was doing it. Was just really, you gotta understand, like, it was like five of us. It was me, my man Will, my man June, my man Rent, and the big bro, my man 40, and Sean Dew. It was just really like friends just hanging every day, all day, but we were selling drugs.
Now, were there any other opportunities as far as YMCA, Boys Club, sports teams, any type of other opportunities for you guys to get into?
Oh, yeah. I was a very good basketball player as well as Dew. You know, he played Hampton University. You know, I had scholarship offers, you know, offers to play at some top high school in America. But that opportunity couldn't come to fruition because I didn't have family that would be able to hold me down while I was gone. So that dream faded away fairly quickly. And then when I had, you know, I had my kids at like 17 years old. So it was like, what am I going to do? Go to school and leave them in the streets or make some, you know, try to get some money and take care of them.
Right, right, right. So you joined one of the most notorious gangs, right? The Supreme Team. I mean, that was, and I'm in Connecticut. We were, you know, just a, you know, one state over. And while I wasn't into that, certainly to the degree that you were, I mean, I certainly, you know, hung out in the streets a little bit, but my mother demanded I go to the Boys Club and stuff like that. But I did hear, my point is that we did hear about the gangs in New York and Supreme Team and all that kind of stuff. So, and you tell some stories in your book about people getting shot, and one brother was playing pool and took somebody to the back, beat him up or shot him, and then came back outside, came back and just started playing pool like nothing else. What did that do for your psyche? What did that do for you as you saw this kind of stuff growing up?
Yeah, you know, it pretty much hardened me to see that. And you're talking about that situation. I probably was about 11, 12 years old when that situation happened. So for the early age, I was pretty much hardened to violence. I saw so much violence. There's so many stories that I couldn't put my life in 333 pages. It just couldn't happen. So, you know, we had to, like, so you notice the book is in three parts. You know, street executive and being a cop. So it was just so much that I could do. I couldn't put it all in there. But all of the things that I did made me into the person that I am today. And it hardened me. It hardened me to see that stuff. So it was pretty cool when I became a cop and I would see somebody shot, or I remember the time where five people's heads got cut off or what have you. You know, other cops are throwing up. They're, you know, nervous. For me, it just was the life. I saw that stuff, people getting shot, robbed, cut up, stabbed, dead on the ground. you know, I don't know if I wrote, I think I put that story in the book where there was a guy, we heard some shots and went down a block and he was shot in the face like five times sitting in a car. And they didn't even rob him. It was just a hit to murder, a murder. So I was at a young age, I'm pretty much hard into that whole violence thing to see this. It was just, it's always been a way of life for me.
And have you had to talk to anybody about that or do some type of detoxing, or was the book it or your way of getting all this kind of negative energy out?
Yeah, you know, the book really was self-actualization, right, in the book. And I tell everybody, it's funny, if you sat down and just wrote your life, you know, it's like my last name. It took me all these years to realize why my last name is Pegues and my father's last name is Sloan and my mother's last name is Cable. Because she used to be married to somebody named Cable. And when she was on welfare, the father couldn't be around, so she had to give me and my little sister her maiden name. So it was all therapy writing the book. And I laid everything out. I was very transparent. But I never had any nightmares or anything where I needed to go sit down with a psych to talk about things. For me, it's always just been like pushing it, you know, something happened, so move on to the next thing. It's never really been a problem for me.
Right, right, right. So as you're growing up, you decided to have that exit strategy to join the military first and then join the NYPD. Was there ever a thought in your mind that this is the police are negative, right? This type of negative interactions that people don't want to be cops that we're dealing with today. Did you ever think that way, even when you were doing what you were doing, even while you were hustling, that the cops were against us or whatever?
I always had a negative aspect about police from just growing up to where I grew up. You know, again, they was getting paid off. There was times where they would come through the block, go through your pockets, take your money and roll out. It was a very corrupt situation. You know, the 70s, it was the Serpico thing. So, you know, Serpico had died down. You know, once those commissions died down, then, you know, they come back out to play. So it was a way, again, that's how the police were. I had a negative kind of, you know, I just had a negative feel about the police. But what I did also have was a positive police role model who was at my high school who encouraged me to become a cop. So for me, it was like I'm in high school. I'm in 11th grade. I got two kids in 11th grade hitting senior year. And it was about how I'm going to get some money for these kids because I was worn out from the streets. So I was hustling for 5 years from 13 to 18. If you're hustling that long and you're not dead or in jail, you're just lucky. So you need to get on your knees, pray, and say, yo, let me get out of here. And so he gave me a very positive outlook on police, not necessarily police, but, yo, this is a job you can get. You can take care of your family. It's good benefits, take care of your kids and the whole nine. And so I said, man, if he could do it, I know I could do it because he looked like me. He was black. And that was rare way back then. He looked like me at this big afro. he talked like me. He sounded like me. It was like, man, he's saying this is cool. And I'm mentally worn out and physically from this drug game. And I saw so much, you know, I got to go.
Right.
So it was easy. And he told me it'd take a couple of years. And that was the reason I went to the military, because when you take the test, you don't become a cop in 2 weeks. It take a couple of years for the background investigation. So I figured if my exit strategy worked, and I tell people, I mean, I'm just one of the few people in America, like my plan actually worked. I only had two jobs in my life. I was a hustler and I was a cop. I never liked working at McDonald's or none of that other stuff. So it actually worked out for me, which it don't really work out for people.
I got you. So did you, now, at an early age, fairly early age, you realized the difference in education systems, right? Because there was something happened in one of the nicer schools that you were at. I think you were playing basketball at that school. And then they wanted to send you back to I think it was Andrew Jackson School. And that school was like a dropout factory or something like that. So you knew that there was a difference in the education. I'm bringing this up because there's a difference in educational systems where you live and why some kids turn out, for lack of better terms, bad, and why some turn out good, just the educational system.
Oh, yeah. So I grew up in Queens, New York. And, you know, back then, it's funny because you would ride around. It was like any normal middle-class neighborhood in America. But at night, the wolves came out. It was a very violent area. The schools were really bad, didn't get any funding. one of the most violent schools in America, in New York, Andrew Jackson High School. A lot of gangs. It was a lot of gang turf wars going on. And I was like, I didn't want to go there. So after junior high school, I took this aptitude test to see if I could score high enough to go to another school that wasn't in my zone, like Andrew Jackson. I scored high enough to enroll in Newtown High School, which was one of the top schools in the city at the time, in Queens for sure. And I qualified for the engineering program, which is, I was like, great. So I could be an engineer. I know they make a lot of money and I get to build some things. This is fine. But, you know, not being able to leave the streets and playing basketball out there, I invited my friends who I sold drugs with to come to the game one day. And, you know, I let the readers read the book to find out what happened. But, yeah, that's exactly what happened. That dream went belly up. You know what's funny and ironic is my high school coach just reached out to me on Twitter. He must be all of maybe 80 years old right now, and was like, "Hey, Corey, I'm very proud of you, how you turned out." And that was cool. Mr. Warren Albert. That was nice. That was nice of him to reach out to me.
That was definitely nice. Definitely nice. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because he probably thought I was going to be a dead end jail too, you know, way back then.
Right. Right, right. So fast forward to all this time of growing up and trials and tribulations, go to the Army, go away for a little while. Then you take and pass the NYPD test. And so you get on and you have this ditty bop, right, that you talk about. You had this walk about you. And
yeah.
I want to talk about what you faced as a cop. Now, what year was it when you came on?
92, January 92.
92. So you came on 1992, and you still faced a lot of racism. And let me tell a story about when I came on a little bit after you. I came on in 95, and we're sitting there doing the paperwork to come on to the test, right? Filling out your social security number and your beneficiaries and all that kind of stuff. And so once we do that, this guy, we get to the portion of it where it talks about how many kids do you have? And I'm the only black person right at this. There's like maybe 10, 12 of us or something like that who are getting hired on at the time. And the guy who's saying is like, how many kids do you have? Put down how many kids do you have? And he kept looking at me. You don't have any kids. But he's like talking to the whole class, but he's looking at me. How many kids do you guys have? Make sure you put them all down. You sure you don't have any kids? I'm looking at this dude like, is this really what I'm walking into? This is my first, we're not even cops yet. And this guy's talking to me like right. This.
Exactly. Yeah. They always look at us as a negative look all the time. But I've always used it as motivation. You know, from the mid 70s when my mother made me watch that 5-part series called Roots, I was affected in a way that I was like, never in life am I going to allow a white person to think they're better than me. So I carry that to this minute, to this actual second right here. I carry that with me. That movie was like, that 5-part series really touched me. Because you got to understand, after I saw that, I was being bussed out junior high school. I was being bussed out to a white school, Brown versus Board of Ed, so they was integrating schools. They were sending me 4 towns away to go to school. And the racism was alive and well. It was chasing us, throwing rocks, spitting at us for no reason. I'm like, what the hell is going on here? We just was getting on the bus and it was these white kids was just racist. And it was just crazy. So the police department, I was getting, you got to understand, the numbers was low, probably about 9% out of 50,000 man force, 9 to 12%. Was African American, black. And so, you know, the prime positions were in there. You know, I write that one story in my book where me and my partner, Kate, graduated the exact same day. We wanted to go to this elite unit. We had 2 years on the job. We filled out the paperwork. A week later, they sent me a letter in red letters saying, you need 3 years to apply. The same day, they sent him a letter and say, you got an hour to get down here for your interview. So I'm like, damn. What the fuck? Already? What is this all about? And he looked at me. He was a nice guy. He looked at me damn near with tears in his eyes like, Corey, I'm sorry. And I was like, yo, man, I'm sweating. It's all good. that's I knew. I said, I got to go to the top. I definitely got to go to the top because I'm here on the low on the totem pole. I'm never going to get anything out of this.
Were there any barriers to, I mean, of course, that's certainly one, a big one. But did people try to sabotage you along the way, tell you not to study, tell you you couldn't be it, you could not make sergeant, you could not make whatever, or any other barrier?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I tell you a funny story is, this guy right now, my son goes to a private school in Long Island, my little son, one of my sons go to Long Island to a private school, and the security guard used to be a sergeant in NYPD. Not only that, but when I was a cop in the NYPD in the 114 precinct, he was the narcotics module sergeant in that same precinct. So I was working there maybe 2 or 3 years, and he would come up to me and be like, yo, I want you to come on over to my narcotics team to be an undercover. And I used to look at him like, well, you trying to get me killed? Now I've been here for 2 or 3 years working. You think these people not going to know that I'm a cop? Now, you want me to go? And I was like, nah, I want to do what you do. And he would be like, nah, you don't want to do this. It's a lot of reading. You got to study. Well, you'll be a great undercover cop. I said, I'm not buying all. And my mind is like, all of these drugs I sold to people, black, white, and Asian, there's no way I'm dealing with it. I left the streets. I'm not dealing with that anymore. They couldn't pay me enough to be an undercover cop. And I knew coming out of the military, because the police is a paramilitary organization, I knew where the power lies. The power lies at the top. I never forget the first day I came to roll call, and my commanding officer, his name was Ryan Thomas, addressed us. I was my first day as a cop, and I was looking at him saying, one day I'm going to be a captain. He came there all disheveled, looking crazy, probably drunk. He was Irish in there. They stayed drunk. And I was like, this guy got all the power. I need that. He was part of my motivation also.
Did they know when you were a cop, did they know about your history and background? Did they know you sold drugs, or did they only figure it out when you wrote the book?
Yeah, they didn't know anything. I had a couple of close calls where people be like, yo, I seen you somewhere. And I was like, nah, you never seen me. I knew who they were because of my street smarts. You know, when you're in the streets, you got to know everything. You know, you got to play the war, look left, right, and in front. Nobody can run up behind you. You better remember every single face that ever come your way, because that face could be the face if you don't run up and kill you. So facial identification is very serious when you're in the streets, more even as a cop. You know, more than even being a cop. I know a bunch of cops, they just like floozy. They couldn't, guy walk right in front of them and then go around the corner. They'll never remember the guy. But I always knew, if I saw you one time, I'm never going to forget your face. Might not remember your name, but I'm going to know where I seen you at, what the circumstances were. So this one time when this guy approached me in the police department, he was like, yo, I know you. You from Queens? Like, I grew up in Queens, but not that side. He tried to buy drugs for me. I distinctively remember him trying to buy drugs for me. And I'm nervous saying, wow, I just got made. Like, I changed my life, and this guy's getting ready to blow everything for me. But he wasn't smart enough to figure out where he knew me from.
Now, if he would have busted you, I mean, you were never arrested. Would you have been fired or I mean, internally?
Depending on, so, you know, you're on probation for 2 years. It was early in my career. I don't know if I, you know, was under 2 years. I was over. But you know how they play. They would have figured out some kind of way to probably jam me up.
Okay.
Because you got to understand, I worked for the Supreme Team, which is loosely associated with one of the most infamous murder of a police officer in the history of America. So putting my name to that flow chart, there's no way they would allow me to be a cop all these years.
Right.
There's no way.
Right. So talk about your...
Not that I, and again, the disclaimer, I had nothing, absolutely nothing to do with the homicide or the murder of that police officer, but just being loosely associated probably would have been a problem.
Okay. Oh, well, I'm glad you put that out there. So talk about your rise to the top, man. So, and before you get to that, let's talk about the street smarts between being an officer and being a drug dealer. And the reasons I was asking those that question and the questions about the difference in education is because I think that kids really just needed opportunity. And you took an opportunity and you excelled at it, right? So you started at 13 selling drugs. You remember these faces. You're doing what you got to do, staying smart. And as you said, even lucky sometimes, but you're able to even excel in that. And people who read the book will understand that you kind of moved up in that drug dealing environment. And then you become a cop and you're still moving up and still advancing. So there's a certain level of intelligence, and it's really about opportunity is my point. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I wish I was Einstein. I'd be making $500,000 a year. But it's not. It was a little bit of intelligence. I worked hard. Like I wasn't. I tell people all the time, I wasn't an A student. Sometimes not even a B student. I was able to just coast to get it. You know, to pass my grades, even in graduate school and the higher collegiate level, I had a 3.9 and a 4.0. But then, you know, I'm grown man. Then I'm saying coming through, I wasn't like this book smart guy, but I knew that I had to do enough to pass, to get along. And I was very smart, again, street smart. And I had a photogenic memory. This is why when you ask me about passing these exams, I would be taking these exams and the answers would be flying off the page because I could just close my eyes and see that I read it before. Like, I would be nervous taking these exams saying, it's no way I did this good. Just before the answers would even come out, I would say, hey, come out of the exam and tell these guys who took the test with me. I said, yo, I'm going to be a sergeant. They'd be like, yo, Piggies, man, you bugging. I said, if they don't make me a sergeant, somebody stole my test. Same thing as lieutenant. Yeah, because I just knew because I put the work in. I put the work in. I studied relentlessly. Every single day. And my motivation would be like, hey, every time, it's almost like Puff Daddy. When, you know, I never forget Puffy said, every time I close my eyes, somebody else making money. So I don't have no time to sleep. And that's what it was for me. It's, yo, every time I close my eyes, somebody else is up studying. They're going to take my spot. And so I use this motivation. Again, you know, in the police world, you're in the police world, these rules and regulations that we follow, there's, you know, ain't no big words in there like saluda, folliculitis, barbe, which is a long word for shaving bumps. It's just on 6th, 7th, 8th grade level, but it's about the retention, how much your brain can retain, because if it was rocket science, we all be rich again. But it's how much you put into it.
So talk about your rise to the top there. Some of the struggles you have as people thinking you're going to fail. They're out to get you. They're not helping you out with different assignments. And as you're moving to the top of the NYPD.
Yeah, man, it was a struggle. You got to understand here, I'm coming right off, fresh off the streets. You know, I got tattoos. I got this Diddy Bop that I have today still. so I'm walking, you know, I talk a little street slang when I want to. I can adapt and overcome. We want to do Wall Street Journal. I could do that New York Times. If we want to do, you know, whatever, I could talk some street stuff too. So I was like Police Unusual. I'm like this first wave of hip hop coming in, and I'm like all the way hip hop. I'm coming to work with do-rags on. My pants are sagging a little bit, not like today. You know, I show the top of my drawers. They showing their whole ass. But you know what I'm saying? So I'm coming in with this whole hip-hop swag, and it was just like, he's not supposed to be here, because you do know that in the police profession, they lock you in. You're supposed to be one type of person for your whole life. This is what you're supposed to be. With hip-hop ain't even supposed to have, you know, no chance to remotely be a cop. And so I was just breaking glass ceilings. I really literally was breaking glass ceilings. I had cornrows. They didn't know what to do with me. Like, they changing rules on a regulation saying your hair got to conform to the shape of your head. And I'm looking at them saying, well, when you have braids, it definitely conforms to the shape of your head. They didn't even know what to do with me. They didn't even know what to write. And it just was different. They wouldn't transfer me to like the Zybor assignments that I was looking to go to. Internal affairs was constantly following me all the time, trying to get me on stuff. And it's funny because for 21 years of my police career, I was probably the cleanest cop for 21 years. And the reason was is because I had already did all my dirt. You know, I always tell people, you know, when you little, you play cops and robbers. I always ask kids. I just did a speech out in high school the other day. I was like, have you ever played cops and robbers at the same time? You can't be the cop and a robber. So that's why most police officers, they getting locked up all the time because they want to be a cop and then they want to do something corrupt. Once I left the streets, I was done with the robbing. When I became a cop, I was straightforward, straight as a cop. And I would be like, damn, y'all wasting resources. You know, for internal affairs to follow you, they probably got a 3-car package. They got like 7 or 8 people following you. You're wasting resources following me because I wasn't doing anything. But that's what I had to endure. Setups, they planting things, you know, in my vehicle, like, you know, they put some money in there, see if you take it. I'm like, nah, you're going to turn this in. But I was so focused because my motivation once I became a cop was to take care of my babies. So it was nothing more important than me taking care of my kids. And I knew if I did anything, my kids wasn't going to be taken care of and I was going to tarnish my name and my kids for forever.
Right. So you were there for the whole stop question and frisk, or stop and frisk, as most people call it. So talk about that. Right. I know Mayor Bloomberg has tried to apologize. You know, I know he's dropped out of the presidential election right now, but he's tried to apologize and all this kind of stuff. So what was your thoughts when this was going on, and what are your thoughts about it today?
Well, again, I'm glad you asked that question because I'm an advocate for stop, question, and or frisk. So. And the reason that stop, question, and frisk is if there's a reasonable suspicion or probable cause that a crime has occurred or is afoot, then the cop should be able to stop, question, and frisk for their safety. So I always give the example, like right now, if I'm a cop and somebody comes up to me and says, hey, I was just robbed by 2 male whites around, you know, right around the corner. One had a red hoodie on, one had on blue jeans. There's an expectation you want the cops to go get them. So if the cop go around the corner, they see somebody with a red hoodie and blue jeans, that's reasonable suspicion to stop the person because you just got that description. Right. So what happened is what the NYPD did, they went from that to, and when we first did it, we was getting results, big results. When you look at it from the early 90s, the crime drops was like 20%, 25%, 15%, 18%. And then fast forward, I mean, and we was doing that was 20,000 stops, 10,000 stops. Now you fast forward to 2008, 750,000 stops, a 2% decrease in crime. And nobody was saying, whoa, something is going on here. So what they was doing was jump outs. That wasn't what stopping question and frisk was about. Rolling up on a corner and throwing everybody against the wall and seeing what you could get. Yeah, if you throw 100 people against the wall, in Brownsville, which I think is the most violent place in New York City, yeah, you're going to come up with a gun or two. But you got 98 people that you just violated their rights. So that's what happened. Stop, question, and frisk, when done properly, is a great tool, like the example I just gave you. And no citizen in America is not going to say that they don't want the cops to go stop somebody if they just told them that they got robbed. Nobody's going to say that. If they say that, they're playing themselves. But you don't want them jumping out on people for no reason, just to say, hey, and you know, I think I put an example in my book. My partner like would be like, yo, let's stop these people. And I'm saying, yo, why you want to stop them? You see, yo, he got this hoodie on. I said, did you see me come to work today? That's called fashion. That's fashion. That's what we do. That's what we wear. We wear do-rags. Our pants sag a little bit. We wear hoodies. Now, what are they doing in the white neighborhood? They got leather jackets on with chains and holy ripped jeans. Are you going to stop them all? That's the punk rock look. Yeah, we dress hip hop. So I had to like acknowledge and explain to him, like, nah, that doesn't mean he's a criminal. That's what they wear. You know, but if I'm not there, then he jumps out and violates somebody, right?
Right. So a lot of times we
stop question. Yeah. It's a great tool when done properly. But what happened is, again, it totally went out of control and nobody, and I blame everybody. And I mean, I have tapes right now to this day where you can see me at our crime strategy meeting called ComStat, and the 4-star chief of department is grilling me saying, Corey, you don't have enough stop, question, and frisk for the last 30 days. And I'm saying, well, chief, there was nobody to stop, question, and or frisk. Well, last year you had 100 stops and now you only got 75. You're 25% down in stops. And I'm saying, Chief, there's nobody out here to stop. And by the way, did you notice our crime is still down? And they're like, no, forget about the crime. You got to stop more people. They had drunk so much of this stop question and frisk Kool-Aid because of the results. Everyone in that position as the commissioner wants lower crime. So they was doing it by any means necessary. And I was the only one standing up saying, hey, this ain't right. Stop. It's over. And I would tell my cops, listen, I don't care. If you got somebody you need to stop, you stop them. But if it's not a good stop, don't do it. And I'll deal with the backlash. And that's exactly what happened.
So what do you think about Bloomberg's apology? I mean, is that simply something he did just to pander to the black community?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know if you follow me on Facebook. I pretty much broke it down. 12 years being the mayor, 4 years he brought, actually. He brought four of those years. 12 years being the mayor, 12 years out of retirement from being a mayor, and now he has an epiphany to say he's sorry.
Right.
I'm not buying it.
Right.
I'm not buying it.
Right.
So, right. And I'm not buying it. So, but it's all his politics. But I don't buy it. I don't care how sincere he looks. You had a lot of years to apologize, but all of a sudden you want to run for president, you want to go on a tour, and these fake pastors. Yeah, and I'm calling out the biggest church in New York City, CCC, with a black pastor, Pastor Bernard, has the nerve to have Bloomberg sitting up on his pulpit saying that bullshit. Yeah, I'm calling him out. I'm calling him out, Corey Pegues. Bullshit is all bull. How dare you even disrespect your parishioners by having this man come up there and do some fake apology. But he probably gave him a big donation.
Well, tell us how you really feel there, Corey.
Yeah, I just call it how it is.
So you were there for 1999 Amadou Diallo, a result of the stop and frisk. And I was a cop at that time, obviously. And I can remember when this whole thing happened, people were calling me saying, you know, what do you think about this? And I'm trying to explain it to them, trying to say, you know, what the cops were thinking about at the time a possible threat, and they don't know, and they got to be careful and safe. And as I'm explaining it to them, I don't know if I believed it, and you know, but I'm trying to convince them. And so talk about that whole situation.
Yeah, the Amadou Diallo situation. That's the one with the nightstick, right?
No,
is that the one with the nightstick? Oh, that's the one in the Bronx, the shooting,
41
shot.
Yeah. What was the dude with the I'm trying to think.
No, it's cool. LaWima was the nice thing, right? The Amadou Diallo.
Yeah.
Amadou Diallo, if people really, really drill that. So what happened with that is, yeah, there was this rapist out there, whatever. These street crime units was out there looking for somebody, and they approached him. So what happened with that one is when he's in the festival, the first cop that came up there, whatever in his mind thought that he was reaching for a gun, he started firing. And then after that, they had what we call in the police world, I forgot what the name of the term for the firing. It was almost automatic.
Firing.
Yes. So what happened was the other three cops, they weren't on the steps with that first guy that let the rounds go. So in the cop's mind, you're expecting that, like, your partner, if he's shooting, somebody really has a gun. And they start shooting. These bullets, you got to understand, these bullets are ricocheting. So they're thinking that this guy's shooting back. He wasn't shooting back. Those bullets was coming back. They was ricocheting off the metal, off the brick. And they thought they was being fired upon. That's exactly what happened with the Amadou Diallo. And this poor man was murdered by the police. Listen, I talk a lot on TV and stuff, radio, about cops being bad, and I'm calling a spade, but I know one thing, I know in my heart, I don't know any cop that goes to work and say they want to kill somebody. So when you look at these incidents, you have to really, really drill them down, and this was a tragic incident. The cops should never be cops again, because, hey, it's a heavy responsibility to pull that trigger, and if you don't do it right, then you shouldn't be a cop. I totally agree with that, but I don't think those cops went there to murder that guy. Now, the Abner Louima situation, definitely he had intent to stick that stick up inside of him and injure him.
That didn't happen accidentally.
Right, that wasn't accidentally. You understand what I'm saying? So you could look at all these separate incidents. Sean Bell, 44 shots. I mean, you could just go down the line. These cops don't go to work and wanting to kill somebody, but somebody got to be a leader. Like, did anybody say, hey, stop, after three round bursts, boom, 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 take cover? You know, this is what we taught. It ain't 15 round bursts, reload, clip, drop it, drop again, then say stop. No, it don't work like that. 2-3 round bursts, pop, 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 cover, look, try to clear the target, see what's going on. But when you just like, pop, 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 like, come on, it doesn't make sense.
So why do you think that these incidents happen? You mentioned Sean Bell.
You remember this guy? Remember that first guy? Just really quick, we can end on the Sean, the Diallo thing. When he did that fire, his first few fire, he fell down the stairs. So they thought they thought he was shot. That's crazy, right? I think it was Murphy, the first guy that did the shots, I believe.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You're talking about the cop fell down the stairs.
Right.
Right.
Okay, that's it. When he thought Diallo had the wallet, you know, he's backing up down the stairs, he fires, and he falls down the stairs. So they hear a gunshot, they thinking that their partner got shot.
Right.
So, like, some of these things, they just happen instantaneously, but again, you know, I'm a total advocate. Was the police get paid the big bucks? We're expecting you to make sound decisions,
right?
Professional decisions. Because the only person in all of these incidents that got $100,000 training is the cop. Dude in the street ain't got no training.
Right.
He ain't getting trained. He just pulling his gun out to shoot a cop. He ain't get behind no cover, no concealment, giving clear and concise orders. Police don't move. He ain't doing none of that. But my expectation is for you to do all of that because that's the training that you got.
That's a good point. Really good point. I got two more questions for you. You were not working during 9/11, but just tell us about your recollection.
Actually, I was working during 9/11.
Okay.
Yeah, 9/11. Actually, I glaringly remember 9/11. My daughter had a dentist appointment that day. And I couldn't take off, so I was like, I'm going to just leave early. So the first plane, I was at work, I was in the precinct, and the first plane hit, and I was like, oh, man, let me get out of here. But I'm like everybody else. Some psycho pilot can't drive the helicopter, hit a building, because we don't know at this point. It, like, just hit, so I'm signing out, like, yo, I got to get out of here, hurry up, because they sent me to Manhattan for some nonsense. And as I'm driving to go pick my daughter up from her school, by the time I get to her school, I was working in Brooklyn, she was in Queens. By the time I get to her school, the second plane hits and it's chaos. We know that it's a terrorism attack. Now, D.C., all of this, you know, Pennsylvania, all of this is going on. So I was able to snatch my daughter up, take her home. Doctor's over. I'm not doing no dentist at this point. I take her home. And then I go back to the precinct, which I didn't have to, but, you know, I was a cop. So everybody, we was all hands on deck. So then I go back to the precinct to chip in and do whatever I could do to help. And then it's the first time the war offense on American soil.
So, I mean, what was going through your mind at that time, right? This plane crash, obviously you situate your daughter, but what's going on once you realize it's a terror attack? What was your response?
Oh, well, you know, then at first, you know, everything is family. You know, where's my wife or fiance at the time? Where's the rest of my kids? You know, I'm trying to get all that together. And then, like, I got to do my part as a police officer in New York City because people, the city is bleeding. I got to get there. And it was just like, we didn't know if something else was going to happen. But I knew that America got the biggest force in the world. And so I knew that eventually the president would lock down the U.S. air space, which he did immediately after that second plane or anything flying would have been taken out, commercial air, anything. So once he did that, then, you know, I kind of knew that we were safe.
Okay. So last question is just about the book and the response to it. I know that you kind of left the NYPD on a less than favorable outcomes. I mean, you retired, you know, good standings and all, but you had some problems or issues after that. But since the problems and what has been the response to the book from former colleagues?
Oh, yeah. So pretty much, yeah, I left in good standing, and that needs to be known. I left in good standing, 21 years good standing. My pension is in full effect. First of the month, every month, that pension come like clockwork, and they can never, ever take it. It's locked in. I get it until I die, and I hope I'm 100 years old because I want them to pay me about $10 or $15 million while I'm retired. So the pension is locked. But, you know, policing didn't want to hear my story because as a young black man, I'm not supposed to change. You know, I'm 50 years old. I sold drugs for 5 years, but they want me to be locked into this 5-year box when I was 13 or 18. I'm 50 years old. They say, oh, you're still a drug dealer. You're a drug. What's a drug dealer? Always a drug dealer. Meanwhile, we got all these cops in prison right now collecting pensions for murder, for rape, for all kind of stuff. Because the New York State pension laws are very ironclad. There's no one in the history in a New York City pension that they took their pension, because you have to go in front of a judge and explain why they take the pension. So you can't go in front of a judge and say, well, when he was 13 or 18, he sold drugs, he shot somebody, whatever. And they say, hey, well, he became a sworn police officer. He went through the ranks. Y'all did background checks and everything. And now y'all find this out after he retired. Get out of my courtroom. Come with me with a real good case. So it's never going to fly. And again, the big monkey in the room is I was never convicted of a crime. Right. Never could be, because all of this stuff I say in my book, what if I wake up tomorrow and say, hey, I didn't do it?
Okay, yeah, it was just a story I told.
Right. It was just a story I told to sell a book. You know what I'm saying? So you can't just indiscriminately take people's pensions. So I'm glad that, you know, the New York State legislators made it like that, that you really have to go in front of a judge and explain why. And I'm quite sure, I'm 300% positive that they probably looked at it and their lawyers was like, it's not going to work. They did everything that they possibly could do because I wanted to come out and tell my story. But I also know this whole thing is about, it ain't about me selling drugs and carrying guns when I was young. It's all about me knowing the person that murdered Eddie Burns. But again, that's what I grew up around. Uh-huh. I grew up around gangsters. All these cops in the NYPD, I promise you, you telling me that none of those cops grew up in Howard Beach, Queens with John Gotti? I know a whole bunch of them.
Right.
I know a whole bunch of them know Sammy the Bull Gravano. He got about 30 bodies he admitted to. They're not firing them. They're not trying to take their pensions. But they're not telling their story like I did. And I told my story because I know there's a lot of young kids out here, white, black, Asian, New York, Europe, all over Ireland. I've been all over and interviewed everybody, and I get DMs from kids from all over the world telling me how my story has inspired them. And that's what it's about. I could have probably kept my mouth shut, started a security firm, been very successful. Actually, people were pushing me into politics, and I could have been successful, but I wouldn't have been able to sleep at night because I wanted to tell my story. And I knew early on that I wanted to tell my story. The piece we didn't get to is I journaled for 21 years. That was a major piece of me getting my book deal. I signed a book deal with one of the biggest companies in the world, Simon & Schuster. So we're having a meeting with Simon & Schuster, Doubleday, HarperCollins, Random House. They came into my book agent's office and they saw all of these journals. They was like, what's in those books? And my agent was like, oh, he's been journaling for the past 20 years. So not only is my story quantified, but it's qualified. It's there. You just can't go back and make up these stories. It was all heavily vetted. Simon & Schuster has a big law department that vets your book. Every single word was vetted and every story vetted. And so I'm just happy that I was able to tell my story and touch some lives. Just came from Penn State University a few months ago speaking, and I'm just out here doing what I want to do, and I don't have to work for nobody but Corey Pegues Enterprise. Well, I'm the CEO, president, secretary. I sweep, I mop, and I don't have to listen to nobody no more. And I'm going to stay that way.
That's what's up, man. That's the way to do it, man.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, man. So you doing speaking tours, just came from Penn State. What do you got coming up?
July, I'll be in New Orleans. And, you know, I'm actually getting ready to sign with the Speakers Bureau. And so I'm expecting a whole bunch of new speaking engagements to come on. I'm starting to get back into the TV mode. And I'm just having fun, man. I'm just living my life and just trying to take care of my kids, man, my family. That's all it's about. But I really appreciate you giving me this platform to get out to your listeners. And can I give any of my social media, or are you going to give that?
No, you go ahead. Later. Go ahead. I was going to give it, but go ahead and give that, man.
No, that's, you can give the social media. Yeah, just go on my website, CoreyPegues.com, and follow me on Instagram, CPegues9098, and Twitter is CPegues. And that's it. Follow me, engage, buy the book. If you're in the New York City area, I want to meet up with you to sign it. And that's it.
And I
keep
really,
it right, not real. You know, that's my hashtag. Keep it right, not real.
Keep it right, not real.
And the reason
real.
I say, yeah, the reason I say keep it right, not real, is because when we was young, our parents always told us to do the right thing. And then this hip hop came along. It was like, yo, I keep it real. Nah, snitches. I'm not no snitch. And I always told people, yo, I keep it right, not real. You do something in front of me, I'm telling.
Okay.
That's why I say I keep it right, not real. You want to do something in front of me, I'm telling. Because I got too much to lose. My right. baby's going to eat. And I'm not going down for your stupidity. So I implore everybody to keep it right, not real.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, man. I'm going to start saying that, too. Keep it right, not real. Because Corey Pegues says right. so.
Exactly.
He said,
and don't forget to get that book is everywhere. Barnes & Noble, Amazon, everywhere. Make sure y'all get that book. Walmart, Target, everywhere.
Absolutely, get the book. It's a very good read, man. It's very, very good read to all the listeners out there. I really, really.
Oh, what about my documentary? My documentary is coming out soon. You could go on theguardian.com to see a 20-minute piece, short on it. Just type in a cops and robbers story, or my name, Corey Pegues. Got it. It's coming out of movie theaters next year.
Okay.
2021.
Okay.
Yeah. So I got a full documentary. And I just signed a major television deal, which I can't really talk about right now.
Okay. Well, listen, you are definitely on the come up, man. So you've been hustling since you were 13. Rose up through the ranks of one of the most notorious gangs. Rose up through the ranks of another big notorious gang, the NYPD. and still on the rise and still doing your thing, and one of the biggest things I like, and we'll end off with this, is the encouragement that you have for the kids, those kids that are DMing you and stuff and just telling you how much of an inspiration you are. And I appreciate that, man, and I want kids to realize that the mistakes that people are making early on in life does not have to follow you for the rest of your life. And and you are certainly an example of that. You made some mistakes early on in life, turned your life around, didn't let the circumstances or people around you bring you down, and rose up to become a high-ranking executive in PD. And I'm very glad to know you and glad to be able to tell your story.
Thanks a lot, brother. See you around.
Okay, man. I'll talk to you.